Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. America has a gun problem. Gun violence is at all-time highs and rising, and yet there doesn't seem to be much political will to do anything about it. And in North Carolina, some would say the opposite is happening. If Senate Bill 50 passes into law, North Carolinians will be able to carry concealed weapons in public without a permit. Advocates say that will make us all safer and are eager to expand gun rights on the federal level as well. Congress is considering two bills to loosen gun regulations. Opponents to this type of expansion, of course, point to the 47,000 people who died in this country of gun-related injuries in 2023, the last year we have full figures for. They point out that suicides account for the majority of gun-related deaths, 58% in 2023, with murder making up 38% of the total. So as the General Assembly debates changes to our concealed carry laws, we consider the potential impact of new gun laws here and nationwide. Chip Brownlee is a reporter at The Trace, which covers federal policy related to gun violence. Christine Zhu is a state politics reporter and government reporter for NC Newsline. And Becky Kirstas is executive director of North Carolinians Against Gun Violence. They all join us for the hour. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. Welcome. So, Christine, let me start with you and the moves in the General Assembly toward allowing concealed carry without a permit. This is happening due to Senate Bill 50, which passed that body in the Senate and is now moving through the House. What is the reasoning behind legislators wanting to allow concealed carry of handguns without a permit?
Yeah, so we've seen some legislators sponsoring this bill. It's passed the Senate. It's in the House now. And basically, this would be constitutional carry as opposed to concealed carry, because people would not need a permit as long as they're over 18 years of age and residents of North Carolina. So in that way, people who are defending the Second Amendment really advocate for this legislation.
So the constitutional carry, at least to me, was a new term. So that means that you're just following the letter of the constitutional law, that the Second Amendment, which gives everybody the right to bear arms. Is that what that's essentially called? That's why it's called that?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Currently, you need to have a permit from a local sheriff's office to carry a concealed weapon in North Carolina. Under the current circumstances, what are the criteria for obtaining that permit?
So that permit you would need to obtain from the local sheriff's office, and you would also need to obtain at least 8 hours of training with the weapon.
And you have to be at least 21 years old to get the permit, correct?
Yes.
Okay. This law, this new law, Senate Bill 50, would eliminate that requirement, the requirement of being 21. You have to be 18. Does it eliminate any of the other hoops that gun owners have to jump through when they buy a gun or carry a gun?
That law would also eliminate the training and the permit itself.
Under this bill, any resident of North Carolina who is a citizen, 18 years old or older, not otherwise prohibited from owning or carrying a weapon, could carry a concealed weapon without a permit. Obviously, some are opposed to this, but is this simply acknowledging the reality? Is this bill simply acknowledging the reality that people already do this? They already carry concealed weapons with and without permits, or is there something more to it than that?
That part is a bit unclear. We've seen a lot of pushback, especially during committee hearings where witnesses are providing testimony against the bill, and we haven't seen as much during those hearings specifically in favor of the bill.
So this new bill does not require the 8 hours of training that the current law requires. Why would you eliminate that? Simply because it's our right to bear arms under the Second Amendment, and there's nothing in the Second Amendment that requires any kind of training to hold a firearm in your hand?
It seems that's the reasoning for the sponsorship, yes.
Wow. Becky, you have said that if this bill becomes law, quote, make no mistake, the research is clear, it will be paid for in North Carolinians' lives. How do you know that?
Yes, so we know this by research of what happens in other states. In West Virginia, after they repealed their requirement for a permit to carry concealed in 2016, researchers found that their gun homicide increased 48% and their suicide increased 22%. We simply cannot afford to be like West Virginia. And another thing that, if you're getting a concealed carry permit right now, you have to undergo a background check, which is incredibly important because in 2023, our General Assembly eliminated the need for a background check if you're buying a handgun at a gun show or online. So that means if somebody bought a handgun at a gun show or online, and then they want to carry concealed with a permitless carry bill, you wouldn't have to undergo a background check there either. So you could never have had a background check to carry a concealed weapon. And this is simply dangerous and unacceptable.
You referenced West Virginia as a landmark situation where they've had an increasing death rate because of what we're about to try to do in North Carolina. Are there other states, is it just West Virginia that's the poster boy for this?
Well, there are definitely other states. Many times permitless carry, it's been relatively new. And so the research is looking at both weakening concealed carry weapons permits and eliminating the need. One of the things that we see in North Carolina, we have a huge problem with stolen guns from residences, from cars, from unlocked vehicles. And gun thefts increase 35% in states with weak public carry policies. So we simply, again, there's no reason for this bill. Nothing is broken. And we see the disastrous consequences that happen when you enact a permitless carry law.
Have anything like the statistics that Becky just talked about, Christine, were any of those discussed, debated, brought up in the conversations in the House or the Senate as they discussed this bill in the legislature?
Yeah, some of those statistics were brought up, but the bill was still pushed through.
And?
We're just seeing some of the senators themselves have brought up the statistics, as well as Becky herself has testified at some of the hearings.
But that doesn't seem to have an effect, is what you're telling me.
Yeah, there were a number of amendments on the bill considering those statistics. The amendments, 5 of them passed, another 11 did not.
So you also say, Becky, that a 2023 national survey found that 77% of people support laws requiring a concealed carry permit. Who conducted that survey?
I would have to get back to you on that. I don't know off the top of my head. Okay. But another important point is and this came up in the debate, when we're looking at law enforcement, they don't know who is legally carrying a gun versus somebody illegally carrying a gun. So it makes their job much more unsafe. And we did hear from 2 law enforcement officials when Senate Bill 50 was being debated in the Judiciary Committee.
And do we have any North Carolina figures about how North Carolinians feel about the need for a permit for concealed carry?
I don't off the top of my head. I know there was one poll conducted, and I'd be happy to get back to you and your listener.
Well, Chip Brownlee is with us. He's a reporter for The Trace, and he covers this nationally. If this bill passes and is signed into law, North Carolina will become the 30th state, if I'm correct about that, to allow what proponents call constitutional carry, which we've already defined. What are some of the other states that already allow this?
Yeah, North Carolina would be the 30th, and it would be, it's one of the last vote-out states in the South, actually. I think that's what's notable about this. North Carolina is really the only state in the U.S. South that hasn't done permitless carry other than Virginia. So it would become the 30th, and it's really a trend that we've been seeing over the last 2 decades. So if you go back 40 years ago, concealed carry was basically illegal in most of the U.S. And then starting in 2003, we saw Alaska adopt a permitless carry or constitutional carry bill. And in the last 20 years, we've seen the rest of the states do that. So
we've had.
it's this trend of allowing more guns in public over the last 40 years.
So we've had 20 years to track here. Has anybody tracked any correlation between rising incidents of gun violence or gun deaths or the use of guns in suicide to loosening of gun laws in general and specifically not requiring permits to conceal carry? Is there any correlation that can be found?
Yes, so it's kind of a complicated question. There's been this trend over time of loosening concealed carry restrictions. So we went from states having, no public carry to something called shall issue, which is where you have a right to get a permit to carry a gun in public. That's what North Carolina has now, to permitless carry or constitutional carry, where there's basically no restrictions. A ton of studies have looked at that trend and found that if you loosen concealed carry restrictions, gun deaths, violent crime, homicide in particular, goes up. In terms of permitless carry or constitutional carry specifically, there's fewer studies because it's a newer phenomenon. It started about 20 years ago, but really most states have done it in the last 5 or 10 years. The majority of those 30 that have done it since, I think, 2011 is when, the majority have done it since. So there have been a few studies, and they show the same thing. We at the Trace actually did an analysis of 20 states that have done this and found that 16 of the 20 saw firearm deaths increase after they adopted permitless carry.
Becky, you are the executive director of an organization called North Carolinians Against Gun Violence. I will wager that if you poll everybody in the state, 100% of them would be against gun violence. But this is yet another example of the culture wars that we find ourselves in and the deep political divide between left and right. And I'm wondering what kind of a reaction you get, because I know that you wrote an op-ed piece recently in the Charlotte Observer citing the rise in gun violence in states where concealed carry without a permit has become prevalent. And you pointed to what you just said earlier in this program, West Virginia. I'm wondering what kind of a reaction you get. Do you get pushback from those who favor concealed carry without a permit or any other kind of loosening of gun regulations?
That's a great question. Sometimes we do get a misconception that we're against the Second Amendment, that we're against guns altogether, which we're not. As you point out in our name, we're against gun violence. And it's been interesting in the debate around these bills that there really isn't a need to eliminate our permitting system. Some may say, oh, it takes too long. Fine, let's solve that specific problem and not do away with the whole system altogether. So that's, and there is bipartisan support for keeping our permitting system. In 2023, a similar bill was brought, was on the House floor, but then it was pulled during the dinner recess because the votes weren't there. People realize what can happen, as we've talked about, people as young as 18 years old with no training and no background check is very dangerous for our state.
She just mentioned, Christine, that there was bipartisan support in these debates in the legislature. Is it not evenly divided? Aren't Republicans for this permit law, lack of permit law, and Democrats against it?
It's been divided. As I mentioned earlier, we've seen 16 amendments on this bill from both sides. Five of the amendments have passed, the other 11 did not. But we've really seen an effort from both sides to sort of collaborate in that sense and just try to make safety in the bill.
Christine Tu is a state government and politics reporter for NC News Live. Chip Brownlee's with us. He's a reporter for The Trace, which covers this nationally. And Becky Kirstas is executive director of North Carolinians Against Gun Violence. We have a lot more to talk about, and we'll get to it in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about loosening gun laws and specifically about a bill that's before both the House and Senate. I think it passed the Senate and is now in consideration in the House to allow for concealed carry without a permit and many other changes associated with that as well. We're talking about it with Christine Zhu, state government reporter and politics reporter for NC Newsline, Chip Brownlee, reporter for The Trace, and Becky Kirstas, executive director of North Carolinians Against Gun Violence. Becky, as the executive director of that organization, I want to get your thoughts on this because there have been several amendments made to this permitless concealed carry law, many of them tabled, others defeated. One that passed would increase the amount paid for line of duty deaths for police officers. Another establishes a college scholarship program through the University of North Carolina system for children of permanently disabled or slain law enforcement officers. This seems to be an acknowledgement of a problem that might be exacerbated should this law pass. What's your take on it?
Yes, I think you're exactly right. You know, Senator Mohammed, who represents in the Charlotte area, in the debate in the Senate Judiciary Committee, really brought up, you know, law enforcement lives will be lost if Senate Bill 50 were to become law. And so I think he offered these amendments as a way to, as you're saying, acknowledge that that more lives will be lost, that this bill puts law enforcement in greater danger.
I just wanted to add, I mean, that this law enforcement opposition to permitless carry or constitutional carry is been a thing in basically every state that has adopted these laws. I'm from Alabama, and I remember a few years ago when they were considering permitless carry, the Sheriff's Association was, you know, outspoken against the bill, and that, you know, that's exactly for the reason that Becky's talking about. It makes it more difficult for law enforcement to know who's carrying a gun legally. And it also just introduces guns to a lot more situations that can then result in violence. There's also research out there that shows that not only, you know, could it potentially increase law enforcement deaths, it could increase shootings by law enforcement of other people. And that's a study that came out last year. So I think that's why you frequently see this opposition.
Christine, have chiefs of police or sheriffs around the state or the Fraternal Order of Police been involved in this debate? Have they chimed in on this debate at the legislative level at all in North Carolina?
Yeah, we've seen a number of police officers testifying at these hearings in front of lawmakers, and they've been opposed to the bill.
In your experience, Becky, does increasing the penalties for using a firearm in the commission of a crime, because that's part of this, I suppose, which we'll talk about, does it have any impact at all on gun violence? Or can we even determine that, given the fact that if you prevent gun violence, it becomes a negative that's impossible to prove?
Yes, I think I'd agree with your last statement. I'm not familiar with the specific research around increasing penalties. What I do know is we would have to, you know, collect data to make sure it's being implemented equitably, that we're not just going after, you know, people of color, the disabled, you know, to try and enforce that law and enforce those penalties. And collecting data on that has been helpful in other states.
Chip, you cover this nationally, federal policy that's related to gun violence and prevention. Do you know if in states where penalties have been increased for the commission of a crime using a firearm, if those increased penalties, in fact, have any impact on deterring gun violence?
The research that is out there on this subject generally shows that it's not the severity of a penalty that deters, you know, violent action or crime. It's actually the certainty of being caught and the swiftness of justice that follows from that. So it's not necessarily that you increase the amount of time that somebody spends in prison for having an illegal gun. It's you make sure that they're actually caught with it and that they're charged and convicted quickly. The actual sentence is not really, correlated with the deterrence.
Christine, these bills that are working their way through the General Assembly are doing so at a time of increasing gun violence. At least that's our experience in the Charlotte area, where gun violence has been up steadily year over year. And some insist that this increase in gun violence has become a public health epidemic. It's a crisis that seems to be confounding law enforcement. These bills would allow anyone 18 or older to carry a concealed gun without a permit. Lawmakers surely know these statistics. They surely know the problems with gun violence and crime that urban areas in this state are experiencing right now. Do they not believe that this could increase those problems, or are they convinced that it won't have an impact?
Well, that's something you'll have to ask the lawmakers themselves. I can't speak on their behalf.
But you've never heard them say anything about this?
I've heard them saying that the proponents of this bill are interested in protecting Second Amendment rights. They've been aware of the statistics. I'm not sure if they've taken those statistics to mind.
This seems to be a refrain we're hearing around the country, the Second Amendment, yada, yada, yada. Chip, is this, we're not the only city, we're not the only state where gun violence is a problem. We have incidents of gun violence every single day in this country. We have mass shootings, at least we did for a while, almost every single week, sometimes several times a week, all committed by people carrying guns, sometimes with permits, sometimes without, etc., etc. Is there no discussion of this kind of thing when legislators around the country and people in Congress discuss loosening the gun laws?
Yeah, I mean, it comes up. I mean, the statistics come up every time, and I think they're just disregarded frequently. The statistics are pretty clear that gun violence is a problem, and that there are certain, policies that, can help improve that problem. But when it comes up to, legislative discussions, those statistics are ignored. And I think it's often for political expediency. I think people, the lawmakers often know the statistics. They just also know that they need to get reelected, and the Second Amendment and gun rights is an issue that's incredibly important for conservative primary voters.
Well, there you go. The primary system at it again, because as I think Becky pointed out, I think it was, no, it was Becky pointed out that I think, but is it 77% of people in North Carolina want a permit with a gun to carry it concealed? Was that what the figure was?
That was actually a national statistic.
Okay.
But yes, we've heard from people, all over the state that they don't want something like Senate Bill 50 becoming law. And I think one quick thing to remember when we're looking at the statistics and research are incredibly important, but behind each and every number is a family, is a community that will never be the same, that has experienced immense trauma. Because of gun violence. So we just always need to remember the survivors, of those who have been injured, those who've been killed. Behind every single number is a family that we always have to remember.
So we've been talking primarily about Senate Bill 50, but there's another bill working its way through the House that has slightly different parameters. And of course, they'll come together when they finally make this bill something they send to the governor for his signature. But right now, this would allow elected officials, the House bill would allow elected officials in the state to carry concealed firearms, quote, while performing their official duties if the official has a concealed handgun permit. And in reporting on this, you quote House Democratic Leader Robert Reeves as calling this a recipe for disaster. What is the reasoning behind this part of that bill? Becky.
Okay. Yeah, that's a very good question. We have Capitol Police. If there's ever, an instance where, heaven forbid somebody brings a gun into the General Assembly, we have Capitol Police there to keep everyone safe. We have, the security system that everyone has to go through now. There's really no reason for this provision, and I don't know why they feel the need to have to carry concealed when they're at the General Assembly, because that really creates a chilling effect on debate, right? I'll leave it there.
Okay. So as North Carolina CHIP is working on their own set of bills, the same thing is happening in Congress on a different set of bills. Let's talk about reciprocity laws.
Yes.
There are bills moving through Congress right now that would allow people with concealed weapon or concealed carry permits in gun-friendly states to carry them into places where cities or states don't have similar reciprocity laws. For instance, today, a lawful gun owner from Pennsylvania, if they were to pass into New Jersey with a concealed weapon, they could face a 3-year mandatory prison sentence because New Jersey doesn't allow that. Should this bill become a law, that would stop. What would be the bottom line impact of that?
It would essentially allow people to carry guns across state lines to really anywhere they want to go. And you really see the opposition to this come from states like New Jersey, like you mentioned, like New York, California, Illinois, who have strict firearm licensing laws where you have to go, you know, through a bit more of a process to get a gun permit to carry in those places. Those states oppose allowing people from other states to bring guns there because other states, like potentially North Carolina, if these bills pass, have looser restrictions on carrying guns.
Well, we have this
thought there is that if you make this easier for people to bring guns across state lines, that could increase trafficking, gun trafficking. It could also, you know, lead to violence is their thought process.
We have this hodgepodge of laws from jurisdiction to jurisdiction and state to state, and yet the Second Amendment is what everybody points to when they say we should have expanded gun rights. That's the federal constitution. The federal constitution wins out over all other laws in the country. So why do we have all these, this patchwork quilt of state and local laws? Why isn't it all covered by the federal government in one sweeping bill or by the constitution itself?
That's a timeless question. I think that goes to pretty much any part of the constitution. If you think about, you know, the right to trial by jury, that's of course in the Constitution, but each state has its own rules. So that's not unusual. I think, you know, a couple of years ago in 2022, there was the New York Bruin decision, which was this landmark Supreme Court decision that expanded gun rights. Since then, you know, it has led to a lot of states adopting looser gun laws. But it's also, you know, made it more difficult for states with strict laws to keep those laws in the books. And so I think we have seen this kind of convergence to a looser, you know, more relaxed gun regulation atmosphere since then.
This attempt in Congress, this bill winding its way through Congress, Becky, which would allow reciprocity. If you live in a state that allows you to conceal carry without a permit, you could cross state lines to a state that doesn't and not be in violation. But this all points back to the other thing that we talk about a lot when it comes to the United States, and that is states' rights. Emma Brown, the executive director at the gun control advocacy group Giffords, says making this reciprocity law the law of the land would be a dramatic infringement on states' rights and be disastrous for gun crime and law enforcement safety. Becky, do you agree? Where do you stand on that?
Yes, you know, that all makes sense, and that, you know, really the progress that we've seen in recent years has come from the states, you know, because at the state level, you know, people know their communities best. They know what the states need. And we've seen in states that have more gun violence prevention laws on the books, their gun violence has decreased. And so it's just, we have to do whatever we can to prevent gun violence, you know, at the state level, the national level. You know, a couple of years back, passed the first piece of gun legislation in nearly 30 years. And that has, consequences for us at the state level. Senator Tom Tillis was one of the lead negotiators. And so it can be done to prevent gun violence at the local and federal level.
The First Amendment, which deals with freedom of religion, freedom of the press, and freedom of speech, the idea of states' rights never comes up. Now, we may not have some of these freedoms shortly. We'll see what happens. But when it comes to the Second Amendment, states' rights do come up. I don't have any constitutional scholars on the panel here, but Chip, is this ever a discussion? Why, if it's in the Constitution, Do states have the right to put certain restrictions on guns if we have the right to bear arms?
Well, I mean, as with any constitutional right, there are limits. The Supreme Court has said that it is a constitutional right to carry guns in public, but there are still limits to that. Some of those limits can be having a licensing or a permitting scheme. When the very conservative Supreme Court released their opinion 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, in the Bruin decision, they explicitly endorsed having permits or licensing schemes. So, of course, those state rights discussions comes up, but the Supreme Court said that it's totally allowed for states to have these regulations.
In all of these debates about expanding gun rights, we hear about the right of gun owners. We hear about concerns about law enforcement safety. We hear, as we just did, about states' rights. In discussions surrounding the laws in the General Assembly, there are also amendments to increase punishments for those who commit crimes with an assault with a firearm against emergency, medical, or law enforcement personnel, while another would increase the penalty for discharging a firearm in the commission of a felony. I didn't see any amendments for civilians who might be injured or killed in the line of fire. Becky, how often do we hear about the rights of those who find themselves in this life-threatening position, or even just being injured? Does anybody ever talk about their rights?
You know, it does come up, I think, for advocates for gun violence prevention, you know, say, what about our rights? Right? Like, just as you were saying, what about the rights for people to live in without fear of gun violence? You know, some people are scared to go to like concerts, malls, shopping malls, grocery stores, because we're seeing, you know, public displays of gun violence, and that's just simply unacceptable.
How much of this has to do with where most gun violence takes place, Christine? At least in Charlotte, a lot of it takes place in what we call the Crescent, which is an area of town that is underprivileged, let's put it that way, where economic circumstances are not the best, and in parts of town that have historically been neglected. Is it because most of the gun violence takes place? If you look at maps around the country, that's the fact. That's where most of the gun violence takes place. Is it because it takes place there that we don't talk about these things?
That's certainly possible. We did see an amendment by a senator proposing that it's still restricted in places where alcoholic beverages are sold, but that amendment did not pass.
We're going to talk more about the national moves on this and our local moves about loosening gun restrictions when we come back with Chip Brownlee, Christine Zhu, and Becky Kirstas in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about gun violence and loosening our gun laws and moves afoot in the General Assembly and in Congress as well. Chip Brownlee is with us. He's a reporter for The Trace. Christine Zhu is a state government and politics reporter for NC Newsline. And Becky Kirstas is executive director of North Carolinians Against Gun Violence. According to the Pew Research Center, since 1968, the number of suicides by gun and the number of murders by gun have all gone up, all increased. Suicides are up from 10,000. This is a lot of numbers, so try to stay with me for a second. Suicides are up from 10,911 in 1968 to 27,300 in 2023, the latest year for which we have figures. Murders by gun are up from 9,425 to 17,927. But when you adjust that to a ratio of gun deaths per 100,000 people, murders have risen from 5.2 to 5.6%. So that's not all that much, it seems, between 1968 and 2023. Suicides are up slightly higher, from 6.3 to 7.6 per 100, 6.3 to 7.6 per 100,000 people. A lot of numbers, very confusing. Becky, what do you take from all of this?
I think I'd go back again as to, we're looking at individual families and communities. I think, when we look at North Carolina, since 2021, we've had around 1,800 gun-related deaths, making it the most violent years of the 21st century. We also have to look at our children. We are failing our children. Guns are now the leading cause of death for children ages 1 through 17. This is simply unacceptable. And so when we look at kind of what is currently happening now in our state, we have a real problem with gun violence, a public health crisis that we need to address.
And the Pew Research Group has published maps that show you where gun violence is occurring and where murders from guns occur and where suicide from guns occur. And if you look at the highest and lowest gun death rates in the nation, North and South Carolina are right in the middle. California, Hawaii, Minnesota, and New York, New Jersey, Rhode Island, Connecticut, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, all on the low end, interestingly enough, while Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and New Mexico have the highest rates. Chip, do those numbers bear any correlation to gun laws in those states?
Yes, they do. The states in the Northeast, New England, tend to have stricter, gun regulations than states in the South. When you look at those numbers, I mean, this is just a fact. There's a correlation between states having stronger gun laws and higher or lower gun deaths. Now, there are, confounding factors. A lot of the states in the South tend to have, poor economic conditions, like you were mentioning earlier, that might also, correlate with gun violence. But, that's exactly why people bring up things like background checks as a possible solution to this, because those, having those stronger gun laws do tend to correlate with lower gun deaths.
And as I just mentioned, the states that have the highest incidences of gun problems are fundamentally in the South, and that is precisely where, Chip, you have said that the moves have been to increase the number of people carrying guns without a permit, concealed carry. So there's a correlation there. Can we anticipate? Maybe this is an unfair question, but can we anticipate that it would become worse should we increase? Should we allow concealed carry without a permit?
That's a difficult question. I mean, it's hard to it, there's so many things going on. So right now, nationally, we're seeing gun violence come down from the pandemic
Right.
highs. That it's important that we also think about what happened with the pandemic in 2020. Gun violence skyrocketed in a way that we had not seen in years. There were more than 40,000 gun deaths in 2020 for the first time. Since 2020 and 2021, we've seen those numbers come down nationally. There's in most in some places that hasn't been the case.
And
But
this
if
is
you see
one.
this
This is
national
one
trend
of the.
going down, even if you see some increase on the other end of that, it can make those numbers confusing.
Charlotte is one of those cases. As the national trends decline, we are going up. Getting back to the laws before the General Assembly, Christine, that would permit concealed carry without a permit. One of the bill's three main co-sponsors in the Senate, Senator Danny Britt, sees this as little more than a modest adjustment to state law because state law already allows the open carry of firearms without a permit. Since that is the case, Does this really increase the danger? You're carrying around a gun without a permit in full view, or you're carrying a gun without a permit that's concealed? Does it make a difference?
We'll have to see. It could make a difference. It could not, but we just don't know for sure yet.
Becky, in your mind, why would it make a difference? If you're carrying one in full view versus carrying one hidden on your person or in your glove compartment, why would it make a difference?
Well, we feel that with the open carry laws that you should have a permit to open carry. Make sure that people have a background check and training. As Christine mentioned, we'll have to see how this plays out in North Carolina, but we are, actively working to make sure that this does not become law, and that, as you're mentioning with open carry, that we start requiring permits to open carry. Responsible gun owners, this is not a problem for them. Background checks, training, making sure somebody's 21. This is there's not a problem.
And again, we get back to the Constitution, because one of the arguments for this in the legislature and the loosening of other gun laws, all based on the Second Amendment and the guarantee of the right to bear arms. And in one of your stories on this, Christine, you quote Western North Carolina Republican Ralph Heiss, asking whether there are any other constitutional rights that we enjoy in which we are required by law to receive state-provided educational information, meaning training, I guess, prior to exercising that right. I thought about this over the weekend. I can't think of any. Can you?
Off the top of my head, no, I can't.
So does he have a point?
Yes.
Becky, you're a woman of few words, Christine. I want to give that to you. But Becky, does he have a point?
I think, you know, we need to look at it in the context, right? Like we were just talking about the increase in gun-related deaths in North Carolina. Going through the permitting system is not a problem, is not a big deal. So, you know, I think when we weigh the risks and benefits, right, of saying that, oh, you have to get government approval, but then looking at, you know, what could happen if we repeal the requirement for permits. I just think it's, you know, the benefits of keeping the permitting system far outweigh the concerns of having it be a government issued program.
Christine.
Yeah, going back to the senator from Western North Carolina's question, there is another right, reproductive rights. If a person wants to get an abortion, they have to be informed about the process of that.
But reproductive rights are not enshrined in the Constitution, are they?
That's up to debate. The Supreme Court has made some decisions about that.
Yeah, I don't think it's in the Constitution. Those who favor loosening gun regulations say it will make us safer, Chip. Average Americans will have more freedom, they say, to protect themselves against dangers. Okay? Is there any empirical evidence that demonstrates the truth of that, or is that claim contradicted by data?
There are certainly hundreds of incidents every year where people use guns to protect themselves, but in the reality of that, it's a small percentage of the overall, you know, level of gun violence. You're far more likely to be injured by your own gun in a situation like that than you are to be able to use it to protect yourself. So I think that the data there is a little bit contradictory. There are certainly incidents where people do use guns to protect themselves, and I think that's what it comes back to when you see these arguments. It doesn't necessarily bother some people that you might see gun deaths go up. If that means that somebody is being able to use it to protect themselves, that's why you see the gun rights side of this make these arguments.
You've been reporting, Chip, recently on several moves at the federal level surrounding firearms, and some of these efforts are working in both directions. But first, let's talk about the budget. Congress recently passed what is known as a continuing resolution to keep the government open for another couple of more months. It largely extends spending levels at the present rate. But at one point, congressional Democrats raised concerns that the resolution might threaten funding for gun violence prevention and research. Do you know if that happened? Was that removed from this continuing resolution? Money for that?
No, it wasn't. I mean, it's still part of it. So basically what the issue was is with the continuing resolution, normally Congress includes specific directions to federal agencies on how they're, you know, supposed to spend their money. When it comes to a continuing resolution, those directions are less clear. In this situation, in previous years, Congress has directed the CDC and NIH to spend $25 million a year on gun violence research. Democrats were worried that with this continuing resolution, it might allow the CDC or NIH to get out of spending that money. And method for that happening was still left in the bill when it passed.
Yeah, there's $25 million in the budget for this. It was split between the National Institutes of Health and the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. But even though that money is still in this budget because of the continuing resolution, the Trump administration has been making their own decisions about how to allocate dollars put forth by Congress, even though Congress has the right, they have the purse strings. Donald Trump has decided no. He knows best, and he's going to do what he wants. So could this money ultimately be cut anyway?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, we've seen that in hundreds of NIH grants that are being cut, millions of dollars in research funding for cancer research that have been cut. I think it's only a matter of time until that, you know, arrives at the doorstep of gun violence prevention. We already know of you know, some research grants that have been canceled. And also, you know, every time the NIH gives out a grant, they have to go through a review process, a committee, and those committee meetings have been delayed. So even if they don't cut the funding outright, they can certainly make it more difficult for researchers to get it and to actually produce the research that helps us understand the issue of gun violence.
So, Becky, the decline in gun violence that Chip alluded to a minute ago nationwide, which we are not experiencing here, but the decline that's happening nationwide is relatively recent. But the Congress has funneled $25 million every year into these gun violence reduction projects at the Center for Disease Control and the National Institutes of Health. They've done it every year since 2019. Has it had any impact?
That's a great question. And I don't work as much on the federal level, so I don't know if maybe Chip could answer that question better than I could.
Chip?
We've started to see studies come out from this research, and this is things ranging from what types of strategies help prevent school shootings. So declare backpacks actually work. These are all questions that we don't really know the answer to. And these studies are starting to come out to help us understand these questions. But research takes a long time. So even the funding that was allocated in 2019 didn't get out to researchers until 2020. And then it takes them, you know, 3-4 years to do the studies. And then those have to be reviewed and published. So we're really just starting to see the research come out from this stuff.
You've also recently reported on attempts to shift the focus from politics to economics when it comes to guns. A group called Guns Down America is focusing on the business of guns and developing a strategy to disrupt the social and economic dynamic that drives up demand for guns in the first place. Fill us in on that.
Yeah, so this is one of the major gun reform organizations on the national level, and I think their thought process behind doing this is that right now, with Republicans in control of the White House, Congress, and the Supreme Court, any actual federal regulation of guns is unlikely, and so they want to go to more the root causes, which is trying to address this question of why people feel like they need guns in the first place, if guns are actually statistically more likely to make you unsafe. And one of the things that they're doing with that is trying to work with, you know, businesses and banks and whatnot to actually invest in communities and increase, you know, the availability of jobs and resources and job training, stuff like that, to make the situations that lead to gun violence less likely.
Just last week, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a Biden administration rule on ghost guns. These are guns constructed from kits, and once you put them together, they are untraceable and they work like any other gun. And under President Biden, the federal government began regulating the sale of kits and parts for these weapons. The Supreme Court upheld that rule, saying it can stand. And conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote the 24-page majority opinion. How surprising was that?
It was a little surprising. I think, actually, though, if you go back and you listen to the oral arguments from the end of last year, it wasn't that surprising. Ghost guns have been an issue that we've even seen some Republican states take action on. And the reason behind that is that they're very difficult for law enforcement to trace, to actually do the investigation into a homicide or a shooting. And I think that concerns people across the political spectrum. So I think there is some bipartisan agreement there that ghost guns are dangerous and they should be regulated like other guns.
Christine, when these two bills that are floating through the legislature come together and are passed inevitably by our Republican-controlled legislature, they will go to Governor Josh Stein, the Democratic governor, for his signature. Is he likely to sign it or to veto it?
He's likely to veto it, but because of the recent election, we no longer have the Republican supermajority in the chamber, so it's unclear if he'll be able to override it.
You kind of were garbled there because of the internet. So you're saying that he will likely veto it, but because the Republicans have lost the supermajority, it's unclear whether or not that veto could be will be overridden. Is that that's what you're saying, correct? Okay. Christine Zhu, state government and politics reporter for NC Newsline, Chip Brownlee, reporter for The Trace, and Becky Kirstas, executive director of North Carolinians Against Gun Violence. We've just scratched the surface of all this. There'll be more to come, I'm sure. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.